Meeting of the Senate Judiciary Committee to order. It is 1:43 p.m. on Monday, May 12, 2025. Before we begin, I want to thank Juliana Singh, the Senate Judiciary Secretary, who makes sure we have a transcript of our meetings, and Doug Bridges from the Juneau LIO, who makes sure we have sound. At this time, I want to remind committee members and all those in the room to please silence your cell phones, especially the chair. Present today, we have Senator Myers, Senator Tobin, my vice chair, Senator Keel, and myself, Senator Clayman. We have a quorum to conduct business. Our first order of business today is Senate Bill 167, Criminal Convictions Overturned, Received Past Permanent Fund Dividends, sponsored by Senator Kawasaki. This is the second hearing of the bill in the Senate Judiciary Committee. We did not receive any amendments to Senate Bill 167 before our previously set amendment deadline. It is my intention to look to the will of the committee to move Senate Bill 167. I'll first ask if there are any questions for the bill sponsor's office. Senator Myers.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. So I did ask the question for the staff after we adjourned last meeting with this bill. So I'm looking at the language that was added in the State Affairs Committee. Looks like page one, line starting on line 12. Having to make sure that the dismissal was not part of a plea agreement. And I'm trying to remember off the top of my head if it is only a felony that makes you ineligible for a PFD or if it's also a misdemeanor. And what I'm wondering here is I'm just trying to make sure that this is the proper language that somebody can plea out and plea down low enough that they're still end up eligible for a PFD, even though they'd had a felony conviction against them, or even misdemeanor conviction, if that is the case, because I can't remember which of those two it is. And I was wondering if staff could elaborate on that just a little bit.
I will note as well, Genevieve Watusik from the Permanent Fund Division is online and available, and if you want to let her answer your question first.
Mr. Chair, I'm happy to take the answer from whoever is most knowledgeable.
Well, should we start with the Permanent Fund Director?
Well, through the chair, we also have Nancy Mead from the courts here, so she might be best suited to answer that particular question.
Well, let's start with the Permanent Fund Division, because some of these are the specifics about who's eligible and who's not eligible, and that seems like a good place. Ms. Watusik, and I apologize
Hi.
If I'm mispronouncing your name.
All
right, got it right.
Thank you. Yes, you did. Yeah, can you hear me okay?
Yes.
Hi, Jenny Watusik, Director of the PSD Division. Thank you for the question, Senator Myers. Under 4323005 eligibility, Section B says, notwithstanding this provision of A through C of this section, an individual is not eligible for a PSD for a dividend when, during the qualifying year, the individual was sentenced as a result of a conviction in the state of a felony, or two, during all or part of the qualifying year, the individual was incarcerated as a result of a conviction in this state of a felony or misdemeanor if the individual has been convicted of a prior felony or two or more prior misdemeanors.
Okay.
Senator Myers.
Thank you, Ms. Matusik. Sorry, that's a lot of ifs in there, and so I'm trying to work through all that in my head on the fly. Okay, so is there then a possibility where somebody could have a previous conviction, makes them ineligible, and the conviction is then vacated as part of a plea deal where it goes down low enough where they are now eligible? Because we want to make sure that somebody's conviction's been vacated, you know, for findings of fact or what have you, or, you know, there was something wrong with the trial, then definitely we want them to get their PFDs back. But we don't want them to get their PFDs back on a technicality. You know, their lawyer holds out for a good deal on a plea deal, if you understand my drift.
Thank you for the question through the chair, Senator. I would defer that to courts or legal. There was a lot of ifs in there, and we don't want to speculate on that here.
Okay, thank you.
So now we'll bring up Ms. Mead.
Good Hello. For the record, Nancy Mead, General Counsel for the Alaska Court System. As through the chair to Senator Myers, as I read the bill, if a person spends some time incarcerated for a felony or for a misdemeanor with a prior felony or priors, in other words, they are ineligible, they will only become eligible and be covered by this bill if the charge, all those charges are dismissed, no plea deal. They can't have it reversed or vacated, and then when it goes back down to the superior court level, plead to a misdemeanor. That they would not, as I read this bill, be covered by this bill. So in that instance, it's not all dismissed. And what was added is to clarify that sometimes the prosecutor dismisses a case as part of a plea deal in another case. So if it is sent back to superior court, but this individual also has a pending any other type of case, the prosecutor may say, I'm going to proceed, I'll drop that if you take a plea deal in this case. And the words that were added is that can't happen either. I think what they're trying to go for, if I were to read between the lines, is basically true innocence and not having the case diminished to something less.
Mr. Chair, that satisfies my concerns. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Any other questions either for Ms. Watusek, to the bill sponsor's staff, to Ms. Mead? Hearing and seeing none. Senator Keel, may I have a motion?
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chairman. I move the Senate Judiciary Committee report out. Committee substitute for Senate Bill number 167, State Affairs, which is 34LS0491/N, as in Nulato, from committee with individual recommendations and attached fiscal note.
Hearing and seeing no objections, Senate Bill 167 moves from committee. We will now take a very brief at ease to sign the paperwork. Oh. Back on record, the second order of business today is House Bill 35, Prisoners, Electronic Device Access and Use, sponsored by Representative Himshute. This is the second of hearing of the bill in the Senate Judiciary Committee. For the committee, we have a committee substitute for House Bill 35. Senator Keel, may I have a motion to adopt the committee substitute?
Thank you, Mr. Document. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I move that the Judiciary adopt Senate CS for House Bill number 35, Judiciary, which is Work Order 34. LS0355/O is in Old Harbor as our working document.
I'll object for purposes of discussion. Here to present the summary of changes is our Senate Judiciary Committee aide, Brianna Kakarik. Ms. Kakarik, if you would tell us about the changes.
Thank you. For the record, my name is Brianna Kakarik, and I'm staff to Senator Matt Klayman. So in House Bill 35, version T to version O, I realized I had a typo in the explanation of changes, so I can send out a corrected version. For the first change, I meant to put delete instead of insert. So we deleted, or as a substitution for in-person visitation, receiving mail, receiving medical services, or other in-person communication. And to address that deletion, we inserted new subsection F, which I can read. So the commissioner may not replace in-person visitation with the use of a computer or electronic tablet. To the extent practicable, the commissioner may not replace an existing program or service provided to a prisoner for the purpose of rehabilitation with the use of a computer or electronic tablet authorized under A3I of this section. A computer or electronic tablet may be used only to supplement an existing program or service. And then on page 3, line 24, there were some conforming changes.
Thank you very much. Any questions about the changes? I would, I'm going to withdraw my objection to the committee substitute, and hearing no other objections, we have adopted the O version as our working document. I would note that at the last hearing, there were some questions for the Department of Corrections, and they weren't available at the time, but we now have both Brandon Jones, who's the superintendent at the Highland Mountain Correctional Facility, and April Wilkerson, Deputy Commissioner of the Department of Corrections, are both online for questions. So if there are questions for Department of Corrections, this is your opportunity. Senator Tobin.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And I'm going to put this out into the ether, and if Deputy Commissioner Wilkerson or another individual would like to answer, I would appreciate it. My question and concern was related to digital literacy or internet literacy, knowing that some folks might be incarcerated who aren't familiar with these types of devices or with having access to particular types of services on these implements, and just curious about some of the training that might be provided to folks who are incarcerated, or what additional services might be there to protect folks from being subject to phishing expeditions, or folks who are trying to take people's identity thefts or other types of things that we've seen online with vulnerable populations.
Go ahead.
Thank you. Through the chair to Senator Tobin. I believe, if I'm understanding your question correctly,
Please identify yourself first.
Thank you. For the record, this is April Wilkerson, Deputy Commissioner for the Department of Corrections. Through the chair to Senator Tobin, I believe if I am understanding your question correctly, you're asking how are we protecting the inmates that are utilizing the tablets from phishing expeditions to ensure that there's no plagiarization or theft in that. Is that a correct understanding of your question?
It is.
Thank you for the clarification. There are the program is operated by a third-party vendor who is really familiar with ensuring the structure and the security elements of the system itself. It is and does operate on a closed network that isn't just wide open to the internet. And so those elements would be flagged and identified by the vendor themselves through their security controls.
Senator Tobin.
Thank you. Thank you, D.C. Wilkerson. That's helpful to know and to understand. And just curious if there has been any conversation within the department around digital literacy or internet literacy in general, as knowing folks who might have access to devices might not have any of those skills have been developed when they were not incarcerated. And curious if there will be opportunity for folks to develop that muscle while they are in our systems of incarceration?
Mm-hmm. Thank you for that question. Through the chair to Senator Tobin, I'll take the first part, and I believe possibly that Superintendent Jones may have some additional information to share. The vendor that is providing the tablets, they do provide some secure or training to our security staff, who then have the ability to train the population. We have had individuals that are uncomfortable with utilizing the tablets, and so they've declined. However, through exposure and training and just having the ability in our pilot program, they have there have been some that come around to utilize the tablets. But I would kind of defer how that training occurs and the information that is being provided in the pilot program at Highland Mountain. Maybe Superintendent Jones can provide some additional information.
Yes, this is Brandon Jones, Superintendent Highland Mountain. Through the chair, we have part of our pilot is also doing an educational program pilot within that pilot project of having the tablet at the facility. We've got 15 inmates who are engaging in this pilot program, taking educational courses, and we focus on those pieces they'll need for employment. One of those programs that they're participating in now is computer skills and literacy, working with our education coordinators so that they can learn those skills and have confidence in using these types of systems, not just in the facility, but after release. And we also have, just for using the tablet itself within the facility, we have some inmate workers, librarians, law librarians, and trainers who work with inmates who are using a tablet, electronic device for the first time, to give them an orientation to that. So we have video and take orientation for them to watch. We've also got hands-on tutorial and a staff member that supervises those workers to help them train.
Senator Tobin, any further questions? Okay. Thank you very much. I don't see any other questions. I do have a question, I think, for Ms. Wilkerson. In looking at the committee substitute in subsection F, the last sentence talks about a computer or electronic tablet may be used only to supplement an existing program or service. What happens if it's not an existing program and has never been offered by corrections, but there's a new program that somebody comes up with that really is only offered as an online course? Does the last sentence of subparagraph F mean that now they have to come back to the legislature to amend the statute if we want to actually allow new programs to come in that are tablet only?
For the record, this is April Wilkerson again to the chair. We would defer to the policy makers for and work with Department of Law for clarification. But our understanding is that our intent behind this is not to only go one way. Our intent, it really truly is to identify efficiencies in processes as well as expanding the ability to get education and other services to the inmate population. We are seeing some providers that are only providing or they're switching to an online platform, which is one of the drivers behind this, is to ensure that we don't lose out on some of those. So we would work with Department of Law and the legislature to try and ensure that we can capture both when the tablets are the only option, that we can try and identify a secondary option for that.
Okay. Thank you. Any other questions? All right. Before we set the bill aside for further review, does the sponsor's office want to add anything? I see you're shaking your head. Okay. We're going to set House Bill 35 aside for further review. Our third and last order of business today is Senate Bill 9, Surrender of Infants, Infant Safety Device, sponsored by Senator Myers. This is the third hearing of the bill in the Senate Judiciary Committee. Before the committee, we have a committee substitute for Senate Bill 9. Senator Keel, if I could have a motion.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chairman. I move that the Senate Judiciary Committee adopt CS for Senate Bill number 9, which is Work Order 34, LS0085/T, as in Tana Cross, as our working document.
I'll object for purposes of discussion. Here to present the summary of changes is the Senate Judiciary Committee aide, Brianna Kakarik. Ms. Kakarik.
Thank you. For the record, my name is Brianna Kakarik, and I'm staff to Senator Matt Clayman. So from version G to version T, the following changes happened. On page 2 from lines 15 through 17, version T removes the authority of the commissioner of the Department of Family and Community Services to designate additional appropriate locations for an infant safety device beyond the approved list designated facilities as requested by the department. And on page 4, lines 4 through 8, version T deletes assessment considerations for determining whether to approve a proposed infant safety device and adds the requirement that the infant safety device must be installed, operated, and maintained according to the manufacturer's guidelines and regulations that are adopted by the department. Version T also adds that the infant safety devices must be inspected upon installation and annually by the manufacturer or the manufacturer's designee and inspected monthly by the designated facility that installed the device. These inspections are required to be logged by the designated facility and must include the testing of the device's alarms, cameras, climate control system, and locks. Thank you.
Any questions about the committee substitute? Senator Tobin.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And you might not have this answer, Ms. Kakarik, and so anyone who can provide it. On that section on page 4, lines 4, 5, 6, and 7, is there an estimation of how much this is going to cost and who will cover this cost of the installation and also the annual inspection? Or is that going to be left up to the entity that takes these boxes?
Mr. Chair.
And I think Senator Myers, who's the bill sponsor, will let him have the first shot at that.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So we put this section together in consultation with primarily the Department of Health as they do different facility inspections. We did talk to the Fairbanks Fire Department and the Anchorage Fire Department. The monthly inspections, pretty much everybody agreed they could roll that in with the regular equipment inspections that they already do. The theory behind this is to treat one of these devices in the same way that you treat something like, say, a fire extinguisher or an AED that already have to have relatively, you know, periodic inspections done anyway, so they'd be able to roll that in without any additional cost. And then similarly with the annual inspection required by the manufacturer, that is also normal for a lot of medical type equipment. You know, the Department of Health brought up the concept of something like a hospital bed. It's the manufacturer or somebody that they send that comes and does the inspections on that. And then when the Department of Health is going through doing their inspections, then they're just checking off that the inspections for those equipment has been done. Department of Health doesn't do the equipment inspections themselves.
Senator Tobin, any follow-up?
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Please.
That's helpful to understand, although obviously a fire extinguisher and AED is a look at a gauge versus this is a box that you put a baby into. Yeah. So obviously there will be a more onerous burden on that inspection process, I hope. Additionally, having very limited experience, I do know that things like mammography machines and such do require inspections. However, that is at the cost of the facility that rents that machine or that leases that machine. They do have to pay for the inspector to come in and provide and service that particular piece of equipment. So I would be curious, knowing that this bill is probably moving today, but I'd be curious to have a better understanding of what the eventual cost will be to the taxpayer to maintain these. Is the cost is going to come from somewhere, and who's going to pay it is my question.
Well, Mr. Chair, if I may. I believe we should have somebody available from Safe Haven Baby Boxes, who is the most common manufacturer in the United States, to give a few more specifics. But I do want to point out again that these boxes are voluntary. You know, we are anticipating a lot of private donations to put one of these things in. But, yeah, it's going to be voluntary between the facility and the and the manufacturer and whoever might be raising the money. So could potentially be a small cost to the taxpayer in terms of, say, municipal fire department if they agree to it. Again, they don't have to put one in. You know, some of the hospitals in the state are municipally owned. Some of them are private. So, you know, Providence or FMH is a 501c3 as well. So that would be rolled into their operations if there's a cost.
And Senator Tobin, I'll just offer my perspective on the language in subparagraph 6 on page 4. The language that says inspected upon installation and annually by the manufacturer or manufacturer's designee, that at least I would tend to think that implies it's on them to pay for the inspection. That's how I at least read that language, because there's nothing to suggest that somebody else picks up the fiscal responsibility. But we actually have, if you don't have other questions, we have Joe Kelsey, Senior Project Coordinator of the Safe Haven Baby Boxes. He is available on Teams, and I think he can provide both invited testimony and answer some questions. And I know I have some questions for him, so unless you have other questions, we can get him on. And Mr. Kelsey?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Appreciate it.
If you want to introduce yourself, tell us your position with Safe Haven Baby Boxes. You can make a brief statement about your perspective on the legislation, and then I know there may be questions. I for sure have a question or two, and others may as well.
Yes, I'm Joe Kelsey, co-founder and senior project coordinator for Safe Haven Baby Boxes. And I appreciate all the statements that have been made. You pretty much described our program almost perfectly. We have a program fee initially, which covers the manufacture of the baby box, plus it includes the initial training and testing and everything for the baby box to go to the location. The location typically pays for a contractor to install it and or having an alarm system hooked up to it so that it can communicate with the local, speaking about a fire station, so that it can communicate with the dispatch center locally to that station. And also we charge an annual fee. Our fees are annually $500 in the states here, and that covers ongoing support for the baby box program, and it also covers for us to come out and do the physical inspection once per year. Now, part of our program is, I think one of you mentioned a monthly inspections of the baby boxes. We require the station to test the baby box once per week, and I think you mentioned that with the regular routine checks of other items that they might have. And that includes simulating a baby being placed in the box once per week so that they can check the mechanics of the box, and they can also make sure the alarm is notifying dispatch in the proper amount of time as well.
Questions for Mr. Kelsey? I don't see any, so I'll ask. As I heard your description, you were describing the $500 annual fee that you charge folks that we call in Alaska the lower 48. In the lower 48, there's a $500 fee, which I assume is the cost of getting somebody there. We're always very familiar when somebody says $500 in Alaska. We think, that won't even get your air ticket up here to do the inspection. And so one of the queries I have is, how is that price going to change? And do you have an idea of what that price would be, assuming you're the ones that provide the box to Alaska?
That's a great question. I appreciate it. And I apologize if I said $500 in the states.
No. Alaska, I understood it that way. You're fine.
Okay. Yes, it is $500 here. I do anticipate it being higher going up there. We hadn't worked out those prices yet, though, obviously, since Alaska doesn't have them. But it would be similar to what a typical trip would be up there for flights and possibly a hotel stay and car rental and the wage for the person to go up there. So that's how we figure it out. We don't make a profit on that. We just figure that to cover the cost of doing that, because we want to make sure, and when we come out to do those tests, we check the mechanics of the box, make sure it doesn't need any maintenance or anything, and also we check the logs of the location to make sure they are doing their weekly testing and answer any questions that they might have. Plus, we also bring extra supplies if they need more of the orange bags that go in the box or anything. We want to make sure that that location has the tools they need to be successful in helping a community member to surrender a baby safely.
And in that context, in the other states where you actually have boxes in use today, do you say you've got a box in Los Angeles? Do you have somebody in Los Angeles that's certified to do the inspections, or are you sending somebody from your factory or from your home office to Los Angeles to do the inspections?
It is somebody from our home office.
And are there any instances when you're using a contractor in another location, or all the inspections today have all been from the home office?
We don't use a contractor to go out and do the inspections. There may be times where we want to, like if they're having issues with the box, if we already have contacts of people in the state that do sort of those things, if it makes it easier for us to have them check the things that they know how to check on the box itself. But that is a rare occasion. We go out and do those, and we have a 72-hour turnaround. So if there is a issue with the box that we can't resolve over the phone, we will either come out or have somebody check it and then come out at a later time to make sure to verify.
Do you have any boxes in Hawaii?
We do not have any in Hawaii. The farthest out we are is Arizona from, we're in Indiana, so Arizona and Idaho are the two farthest places that we have.
Okay. Any other questions? Oh, Senator Tobin.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Kelsey, for joining us. I do have a question, as we have an example here from the bill sponsor around the inspection process being similar to looking at a fire extinguisher, which is regulated by OSHA, or maybe a medical bed, which is regulated by the FDA. And I'm curious of who regulates or what government agency approves the Safe Haven baby boxes.
Well, we actually had a study done and through the FDA. And they wrote us a letter stating that it is not a medical device, so it is not regulated as a medical device. The box does have medical equipment in it, like a medical bassinet. It's an official medical bassinet that hospitals use. And it also has UL-listed parts. We did also have a safety inspection done on it, which gave us recommendations. But we are not regulated at all by a government agency.
Thank you.
Yep.
Okay. I don't see any other questions. We also have available Matthew Thomas, Nurse Consultant 2 with Health Facility Licensing, and Kim Gui, Division Director of Office of Children's Services, if there are questions for either of those. I don't see any. Better turn the page. Seeing no other questions, it's my intention to move this bill and look to the will of the committee. Before we do that, does the bill sponsor's office have any closing comments?
Mr. Chair, I just appreciate the time the committee has taken on the bill. Also want to publicly thank the the Department of Health and the Department of Family and Community Services for their help in putting this bill together and kind of threading that needle, making sure that we hit the sweet spot on the safety, but also aim for that all-important zero fiscal note this year.
Thank you, Senator Myers. I will just note that based on Mr. Kelsey's testimony, it sounds like an inspection done from the factory is not a $500 ticket in Alaska, and it does raise a question of who's going to pay for that, because certainly it's not a $500 ticket. But that's
Mr. Chair, if I could just respond to that for a second. I do understand your concern there, but as Mr. Kelsey said, it's something that's known at the outset by any facility that wants to put these in. And so, that's something that for them to plan ahead for. But at the same time, I can appreciate the, committing oneself to potential further costs down the line. But I also believe that it's important for us to make that an option available for folks.
Okay. Senator Keogh, could I have a motion?
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chairman. I move that the Senate Judiciary Committee refer committee substitute for Senate Bill Number 9, Work Order 34, LS0085/T, as in Tanana, from committee with individual recommendations and any accompanying fiscal notes.
Hearing and seeing no objection, Senate Bill will move from committee. Please stay after to sign the paperwork. And with that, we will adjourn for the day. Our next meeting will be on Wednesday, May 14th at 1:30 p.m. I would note that we, I believe, are now in the 24-hour rule, so stay tuned. I don't know what we'll be hearing on Wednesday, but I would say the odds are quite high we'll be hearing something. So with that, we'll stand adjourned. The time is now 2:17 p.m.